Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. Welcome again to Extension 720. In the minute or so that I'm going to take to do this pre-introduction to our program tonight, a child will die, probably more than one, of starvation in Africa. And tonight, someplace in the United States, possibly even while I'm saying these few words, an innocent teenager will be shot down, caught in a crossfire of bullets. And tonight, surely, somebody's beloved parent or spouse, many people's beloved parents or spouse or spouses, will die too early in life of cancer or of some other affliction. How can this happen if above us and in our lives is an all-loving, all-seeing, all-powerful God? That is the basic question which has hounded human thinking about religion from the very beginning of serious religious thought. It is the problem which in theology is coded as theodicy. We'll talk about the meaning of that word and its etymology as well. As we talk tonight with Bart Ehrman, a distinguished religious scholar who's been with us a number of times before and whose new book is titled God's Problem, How the Bible Fails to Answer Our Most Important Question, Why We Suffer. On to that conversation with Bart Ehrman, chairman of the Department of Religious Studies at the University of North Carolina, and our special guest tonight, as we continue right after the update on this evening's news from Jim Gooden. My guest tonight, on probably his fourth or fifth visit to this program, is the distinguished religion scholar Bart Ehrman, who is chairman of the Department of Religious Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. You were last with us when we talked about your book on the Judas Gospel.
That's right, yes.
And, of course, various other earlier books, including the one about how Jesus has been misquoted and misunderstood.
Yes, misquoting Jesus, as it's called.
That's the title.
Yes.
And in general, you come at things as a biblical scholar, and your training, of course, is very heavy on that sort of scholarship, though it began right here in Chicago at Moody Bible Institute.
Right. Yes. Well, when I was in high school, I had a born again experience and decided that I wanted to be serious about my Christian faith. And I was told that that the place to go is Moody Bible Institute. So I knew nothing about it other than it was a serious place and it was in Chicago. So I came here in the.
And from there, after 2 or 3 years, you went to Wheaton College.
Yes.
Where you finished your bachelor's degree, I guess.
That's right.
Then went on to Princeton Theological for a master's degree and ultimately for a doctorate in biblical studies.
That's right. I went to Princeton because I was interested in the study of the Greek manuscripts of the New Testament, and the country's leading expert happened to teach there, and so there I went.
And to face the fact of life strongly and directly, otherwise it would emerge as we went on talking, but in a way it defines what we're going to be doing tonight. As a consequence of all of that theological training and all of that close schooling in biblical scholarship and in textual analysis of both the New Testament and later Old Testament study as well. A consequence of all of that was somehow you lost your faith.
Yes, that does seem strange, but it's true. I didn't lose my faith actually on the basis of all of my research, but my research did make me question many things that I had previously held.
You lost your faith, as so you tell us in your new book, God's Problem, essentially because of the inconsistencies and the disappointments that you encountered as you worked closely through both the Old and the New Testaments, searching for an answer to the basic question of how does an all-loving, all-present, all-powerful God countenance or manage to allow to happen tremendous misery for innocent people.
That's right. So it was less my scholarship and more my struggling with this problem of suffering that eventually led me to become an agnostic. And that was well after I had done my education. In fact, it was probably just 8 or 9 years ago when I first admitted that I was an agnostic.
But you went looking in the wrong place. You went looking in Scripture. If only you had read the essays or the sermons of the Reverend Henry Ward Beecher, who was, as you know, the brother of Harriet Beecher Stowe, who wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin. And he said, back in the 19th century, suffering is part of the divine idea. We are never ripe till we have been made so by suffering.
Yeah, there are people who still think that, and that's a point of view that I don't find very satisfying. I think maybe our own personal suffering might make us more mature and more spiritual. But in fact, I don't think that there's anything ennobling about people starving to death around the world.
Beecher, in that quotation, I think is talking about ripeness, not merely in the sense of personal maturity, but being ripe for a full conversion to the ultimate religious truth.
Right. Well, for many people, in fact, the massive problems of suffering throughout the world lead away from religious truth, and I number myself among that group.
You have, in the first or is it the second chapter, a long treatment of the horrors of the Holocaust. It rather surprised me to find it there. I mean, though, of course, it's perfectly sensible that you would take that up in such a book. But you go into it in great detail and in horrific detail. It kind of stirred me all over again. And believe me, I've read a lot over my years about the Holocaust.
Yeah, as part of my research, I decided to read through some of the multi-volume Nuremberg trials where eyewitnesses give their testimony, and some of this testimony is just as graphic as you can imagine. And it is a truly harrowing experience, yes.
I don't know whether it's Viktor Frankl or Elie Wiesel who tells the story that in Auschwitz or one of the other camps, Birkenau, whatever, there is a particular Jewish prisoner who has been singled out for special punishment because maybe he stole a crust of bread or something. So they literally hung him up and crucified him on a plank of wood hovering above the camp fence. And somebody, another prisoner in absolute despair, says, "Where is God? Where is God?" To allow this to happen. And another, perhaps a Christian prisoner, points to the corpse hanging up there and says, "There he stands," or rather, "There he hangs."
Yes, this is it's a harrowing story. It's actually in Elie Wiesel's book, Night.
Yeah.
And when I was in Christian circles, Christian theologians would take that story as a way of showing that God is the one who is suffering with us. And I never thought that was Wiesel's intent. Rather, I saw it as that God, in fact, is dying, that God's presence isn't felt anymore. There he is dying on the gallows.
This book begins, as you tell us in the introduction, with a course that you taught when you were still much younger, and still, I guess, a graduate student at Princeton, a course you taught at Rutgers on, essentially, God and in relation to suffering.
Yeah, this is what got me started thinking about it. It was in the mid-80s, and I was teaching a course at Rutgers that I was asked to teach a class called The Problem of Suffering in the Biblical Traditions. Mm-hmm. It was an interesting time of my life because I was finishing my PhD dissertation. I was also pastoring the Princeton Baptist Church at the time, and so I was quite active as a Christian minister. And I decided to set up this course to look at various solutions to why there is suffering according to the authors of the Bible, in part because I thought that many of my students had answers to why there was suffering that weren't biblical, and probably they didn't realize that their views weren't found in the Bible. And so part of it was to show them what the biblical answers were.
Well, you run across four or five different answers, both in the Hebrew Bible and then in the Christian Bible, the New Testament. The first and most clearly uttered, I would suppose, is we suffer for our sins.
That's right. Throughout the Hebrew Bible, the Hebrew prophets say this time after time, just page after page after page, that the reason the people of God are suffering, whether it's drought or famine or pestilence or war, it's because God's punishing them because they've gone away from the Torah. They haven't kept God's word. And so as a result, God is punishing them. And if they'll just return to God, then things will get better and the good times will roll.
Where do we get strong enunciations of that theme?
Well,
from which prophets?
All of the prophets, in fact. This is the major thing that they all talk about. It doesn't matter whether you're reading Isaiah or Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Amos, Hosea. All of these prophets have exactly
the same message. They're all railing against ye of little faith.
Well, and railing against idolatry and immorality, mm-hmm. and people not behaving the way they thought God wanted them to. And they make fairly specific predictions that the Assyrians are going to come in and wipe you out, or the Babylonians are going to come in and destroy you. And it turned out that those things did happen, and so these books ended up becoming scripture.
Or were some of those prophetic railings against the people of Israel written after.
Yeah, some of them absolutely were looking back, pretending to be predictions.
Exactly.
But you know, this point of view.
Post-diction parading as predictions.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, that did happen a lot. But, you know, this view continues to be held by people today. I mean, whenever anybody has something bad happen to them and they say, what did I do to deserve this? This is exactly that point of view, that somehow they've deserved their suffering.
And a variant of that is when an innocent child dies, for example. If one takes that view seriously as a parent, one may come to the horrified realization that it's your sins which caused the death of your child.
Well, I was talking with a pastor a few days ago who told me of a 12-year-old child who had died of a brain tumor. And the mother of this child told this pastor that she realized that her child had died because she had promised to God that she would quit smoking and she hadn't done it. And so the false guilt associated with this point of view is really quite astounding.
What did that pastor say to her?
Well, I think he realized she was in a moment of grief and that he wasn't going to be able to influence her with any sense of reason, and so he just let it go for the time. Yeah.
What would you have said? What did you say as a pastor, because you did serve in a few churches early in your life? What would you say when faced with a bereaved parent or a bereaved spouse in the face of sudden death of a younger person?
Well, the one thing I would not say is that there was a reason for this, which is what people seem to say these days, that there's always a reason for everything. Even back then, I thought there's not a reason for everything, that sometimes awful things happen and we don't know why, and we sometimes never will know why. I think it's better simply to suffer with somebody and to support them than it is to try and give them the explanation for why these horrible things have happened.
We are about to stop for some commercials. That's not an intervention from God. It's an intervention from the gods of commerce, actually.
Yes.
And we need to go on and look through the Bible for some of the other major modes of explanation which have been presented. The Bible isn't totally consistent, but it does address this issue again and again and again, as it must. And so we return to Bart Ehrman doing a kind of popular seminar on theodicy. The meaning of that word, by the way, is of great interest, and we might talk about that as well, all when we return after these words. Let's pause for a moment, Bart Ehrman, and do some simple etymology. Your book is titled God's Problem, but the reference occurs often in the book to a sector or an area in formal theology which is formally titled theodicy. Theodicy is that portion of theology which deals with the problem we're talking about tonight.
Yeah, theodicy is the technical term for the problem of suffering. It was a term that was coined by the philosopher Leibniz, who
also invented the calculus.
Yes.
At the same time that Newton did.
Yes, indeed. The term theodicy comes from two Greek words that literally mean God's justice.
Mm-hmm.
And it deals with the problem with how can God be just given the state of affairs on this earth. And the way theodicy is normally worked out by philosophers is that there are three statements that are typically made in by people of the Judeo-Christian tradition, all of which seem to be true on their own, but when put together appear to involve a contradiction. And the statements are that God is all-powerful, that God is all-loving, and there's suffering. Now, the reason that appears to create a contradiction is because if God's all-powerful, he can do anything he wants, which means that he can relieve suffering at any time, and in fact, he could prevent suffering. If he's all-loving, he surely would want to prevent suffering because no loving person wants somebody else to suffer, and yet they're suffering. And so how does one explain all three statements being true simultaneously? That's the problem of theodicy at its root.
As I was reading your treatment of these matters, and of course in this book, as in all your others that we've discussed, you treat these fascinating questions with great lucidity, at the same time with absolute scholarly authority. But this is a popular, written for general readership, and it will undoubtedly involve millions who will read it before the book passes from full public attention. But as I was reading it, I jotted a few notes, a few questions back to you. But why can't God be unkind or angry or teasing or, for that matter, not all-powerful? That last thought, of course, comes from Rabbi Harold Kushner, who's been on this program, most recently only a few months ago. Why must God be omniscient, all-loving, all-powerful?
Well, that's right. I mean, one of the ways to solve the problem with theodicy is to say that one of these three statements is not true.
The Greeks had gods who were in many ways quite fallible.
Absolutely. And the problem is that in the Judeo-Christian tradition, God is thought to be loving and powerful. Kushner's book was interesting, When Bad Things Happen to Good People. And part of it was interesting because he wanted to insist that, in fact, God's not all-powerful, that God loves people and he wants to help people, but his hands are tied.
Now, surely he didn't invent that idea. That must be from a theological tradition longer elaborated by others.
No, it's a tradition that's been around a long time. He popularizes it.
Yeah.
And he makes it into a kind of a pastoral statement that God is standing beside you, comforting you, supporting you.
Wishes he could
suffering.
Do more.
He really wishes he could do more, but he can't. And so you're stuck with your suffering. And there are other people who've argued that God's not all loving. That's close to what Elie Wiesel argues in mm-hmm. his books, Night and God on Trial, for example, where God is found to be guilty for sins against humanity. And so in that sense, he certainly isn't loving in any traditional sense. There are some people who want to deny the third statement, that they're suffering. But I think people like that tend to be in the vast minority.
Well, except there is a whole religious tradition that argues that suffering is an illusion. Buddhism, essentially,
yes.
says that suffering can be easily dismissed if you just give up ego, if you give up your focus upon yourself and flow with the eternity to which you belong.
Yeah, well, I would argue that that's one of the most distinctive ways that Buddhism is different from both Judaism and Christianity, in Judaism and Christianity, the problem is that God is seen as the creator of this world, and so one has to explain why there's evil in it if there's a good creator over it.
Well, with that, let's go back to the reasons one can derive from the Bible. We've talked only about the first. You're getting what you deserve.
Right. Well, and there's a good reason to start with that, because that is a dominant view throughout much of the Hebrew Bible and found in the New Testament as well. But it certainly isn't the only view. There are a number of perspectives, some of which stand at odds with one another in the Bible. There are some authors who think that suffering ultimately is redemptive, that suffering can bring some kind of salvation, either in the sense that sometimes when we suffer, there's a silver lining behind the clouds, so that something good can come out of evil, or more extremely, that suffering itself brings about salvation. This is the teaching, of course, of the New Testament, that Jesus suffering death is what brought the salvation of the world.
Isn't there a prior position which you do get in Judaism and also carried over into Christianity, particularly fundamentalist Christianity, namely that God is matched or countermanded by another powerful force, another powerful transcendent being, namely Satan, and that his specialty is evil. If we suffer, it's because a force is let loose under the command of Satan, rather than directed by God.
Absolutely. This is a view that scholars have called apocalypticism. It developed late in the history of the religion of ancient Israel. In the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, it's virtually found only in the book of Daniel, which was mm-hmm. the last book to be written. But it becomes a very dominant point of view in Judaism, and it becomes the view, in fact, that Jesus himself espoused and his followers, so that this apocalyptic view is dominant throughout the New Testament.
Jesus has an encounter with Satan.
Yes, and constant encounters with the demons, and he casts them out. And he sees this world as under the control of these forces of evil, and he sees that a good kingdom is coming in which these forces of evil will be overthrown, and God himself will reign supreme in this coming kingdom of God.
So when the great tsunami, the last one, you mentioned it as just another instance of suffering, uncaused, or rather suffering for which there is no possible blame, and in which the innocents necessarily suffer by the hundreds of thousands, we would have to say that tsunami was the work of the devil. He let it loose.
Well, that would be an apocalyptic view. The prophets of the Hebrew Bible would say that God caused it in order to punish people, and the apocalypticists would say that, in fact, God didn't cause it. His enemy, the devil, caused it. And so this is one point at which different biblical authors had different perspectives that sometimes weren't reconcilable with one another.
What would the book of Ecclesiastes say?
Well, Ecclesiastes, it turns out, is my favorite book when it comes to this particular subject. Ecclesiastes would say that we don't understand this world. Our life is short. Suffering doesn't really have an answer. And so we should live life as well as we can for as long as we can, because this is all there is.
Dust thou art, and to dust returneth.
That's exactly right. And so while you can, make the most of it. So this is a view that stands somewhat at odds with the apocalypticists, who thought that history was going to move toward a happy resolution. The book of Ecclesiastes thinks that nothing ever changes. There's nothing new under the sun. Everything's the same. And so you yourself are what matter. You need to grab for life as much as you can.
Then there's another book in the Bible. At least it's one of the major apocryphal books, which gives yet another, a very moving and a very terrifying answer, and that's the book of Job. And we now pause for an update on the news. When we return, let's look at the Jobian response, the Jobian answer, if answer it be, to the question of how God can countenance so much human suffering. We return directly to Bart Ehrman after an update on the news from Jim Gooden. Our guest is the distinguished biblical scholar and popular writer, Bart Ehrman, whose newest book is titled God's Problem, How the Bible Fails to Answer Our Most Important Question, Why We Suffer. And we're deep into the content of that book and the content of that inquiry, and we've arrived at the book of Job. We should stop there for a while, don't you think?
Well, it's the one book in the Bible that is explicitly about suffering. What most people don't realize...
The suffering of the innocent.
Suffering of, yes, why do the righteous suffer? And what most people don't realize is that Job actually has two different answers to this question, in part because there were two different authors who put together our book of Job. Most people are familiar with the beginning and end of Job, where Job is a very righteous man, and the Satan, the adversary, comes up to God. The Satan in this story is like a member of the divine council around God. And God and Satan have this discussion about whether Job is righteous because of what he gets out of it, or whether he has a disinterested righteousness. And God puts him to the test to find out whether he will curse him if everything is taken away from him. And the Satan takes everything away.
Let's just review some of the losses and some of the burdens put upon Job.
Well, he loses all of his sheep and all of his cattle and all of his servants, and his 10 children are all killed.
That's no small burden.
No, everything he has basically.
And he develops a case of boils, as I remember.
And that's the second stage. After the first stage, he still refuses to curse God for any wrongdoing, we're told, which has always struck me as a very peculiar thing to say, because if killing your 10 children isn't doing wrong, it's hard to know what would be wrong. But at a second stage, then the Satan is allowed to harm Job himself, and he is infected with these awful sores from a top of his head to his foot, and he sits on a pile of ashes scraping these boils with a potsherd, and his wife tells him to curse God and die, and he refuses to curse God, and so that's the story at the beginning. At the end, after another 39 chapters of something else, God is pleased with Job, and he rewards him, gives him back twice as many sheep, twice as many camels, gives him all these servants, all this wealth, and gives him back 10 more children, which is, for me, about the most offensive verse in the Bible, actually, the idea that you can replace 10 children. If 10 children die, well, here are another 10 for you. But that's how the story goes. And Job then ends up dying an old man, full of days, and presumably happy at the end. In this way, this story, suffering comes to the righteous as a test to see whether they'll be faithful to God, even though things go badly for them. A somewhat more cynical way of looking at it is that the story is about whether God can win a bet with the Satan or not.
Commenting on this, as he saw it, very false religious promise, the labor minstrel Joe Hill, back around the turn into the 20th century, gets off these lines. Long-haired preachers come out every night, try to tell you what's wrong and what's right. When asked about something to eat, they answer in voices so sweet, live on hay, work and pray, you'll get pie in the sky when you die.
Yes, that's right. the old pie in the sky. And you know, many people find this actually a satisfying solution to suffering, that you will be rewarded in the end. But
all religions offer some sort of reward. Hinduism, classic Vedantic Hinduism, which believes in the karmic cycle of birth and rebirth and rebirth up and down the animal scale until eventually you are perfected. And if you want to, you can choose to join the Brahman, the eternal spirit, and give up individuality. But meanwhile, what your next birth will be, what your next organic representation will be, depends upon how well you carried the burdens of your past life. Thus, if you're in a low caste and suffering a great deal and your kids are dying around you, if you bear with that, next time around you may get to be a member of the warrior caste.
Yes.
And well, on and onward and upward.
Yes, that's right. And the thing that makes Job different from both that Hindu solution and from the traditional Christian solution is that the reward you get in the end in Job is not in an afterlife or in the next life. It's reward.
It's payoff here and now.
It's payoff here and now. If you hold on for a little while, God will reward you. The thing about Job that I was mentioning earlier is there's a different story within that framework story. The vast majority of the book of Job isn't about that. The vast majority is a set of dialogue poems in which Job and his so-called friends, three friends, dialogue back and forth over why it is that the righteous suffer. And in these dialogues, we have a very different portrayal of Job and of suffering. Here in the poetic dialogues, Job is anything but patient. He's completely impatient and demanding, and insists that he's blameless before God. He doesn't deserve this, and he demands that God actually appear to him so that he can proclaim his blamelessness before God. His friends respond one after the other that Job, in fact, is completely guilty, and that's why he's suffering. This is the prophetic view that he's getting exactly what he deserves. At the end of this dialogue, finally, Job demands that God appear to him, and God does appear to him. But instead of explaining why it is that Job is suffering, God overpowers him with his almighty presence and basically makes Job grovel in the dust, since he, after all, is just a peon, and this is God Almighty. And so in this poetic section of Job, rather than giving an answer for why they're suffering, the answer is there is no answer. You can't expect an answer, and even to ask the question is borderline blasphemy. So this is a very different understanding of suffering from the narrative part.
And does that come closest to satisfying you, that finally one yields and acknowledges this is too great a mystery or too great a confusion? There is no answer that we are capable of discerning.
Well, I do agree with that part of it, that there's no answer that we can discern. What I disagree with is that we shouldn't even think about it, and that to question why we suffer is an affront to God. I simply don't believe that. I think that, in fact, as thinking human beings, it's incumbent upon us to try and understand our world around us. So.
Now, you write this volume both as a biblical scholar and teaching some aspects of the Bible to lay readers, intelligent lay readers. You write this also as a kind of personal revelation.
Yeah, well, this...
This inquiry, you say, essentially led you to finally put aside your commitment to Christianity. Why?
Well, I was a very sincere Christian, and I wanted to remain a Christian. I was dragged away from the faith kicking and screaming. I didn't go easily, but I got to a point where I could no longer explain what was going on in this world if there's a good and loving God in control of it. We live in a world in which every 5 seconds a child dies of starvation. 300 people die every hour of malaria in our world. Thousands of people die every day because of parasites in unclean drinking water, and on and on. There are hurricanes in New Orleans and tsunamis in South Africa.
And genocides the world over.
There are genocides, not just Nazi Germany, after which people said never again, but then there's Bosnia, there's Rwanda. Before that, there was Cambodia, and now there's Darfur, and it just goes on and on and on. And if there's a God who intervenes in this world, frankly, I just don't see it anymore. I used to believe in a God who answered prayer, but I think if God answered prayer, we simply wouldn't have these problems in the world anymore.
Well, I'm tempted to ask you, and indeed I'll I'll yield to my own temptation and ask you, just before we stop for some commercials, looking forward to your response in about 3 minutes, to ask you simply, well, if there is no God, what is there? I mean, what, in fact, are we to make of the very nature of existence? And what are we to make of the question, metaphysical questions concerning ultimate reality, ultimate source? How can you finally think about the human condition, or simply about the condition of existence, without positing some sort of transcendent force or being or essence or grand idea or whatever, somehow, somewhere? What are you left with as a formerly devout Christian when you put Christianity aside? You are not of the Dawkins category, it seems to me. You're not, or the Christopher Hitchens category. You're not simply throwing it all aside and saying religion's bunk, there's nothing to it. I look forward to your response after we return from these messages. And we return to Bart Ehrman, and I'm now in a position, Bart, old friend, to ask you, with all sincerity, and I really don't quite know or anticipate the answer, what then are you left to believe in, or what are you left in which you can find serious sustenance?
Well, my view, I actually tell my students at Chapel Hill that I am a believer in the Bible, because I believe in the book of Ecclesiastes. I think that Ecclesiastes probably has it right, that life is short, we're going to die, we don't have long here, and we ought to enjoy it as long as we have. Eat, drink, and enjoy your toil, as the book of Ecclesiastes puts it. I believe that that's right. We have family, we have friends, we have life. Some of us have health. We can enjoy our physical activity. We can enjoy good food and good wine, and we ought to do so. I don't think this is a dry run. I don't think that this is in preparation for something that's going to come after. I think this is all we have.
There is no afterlife.
I don't believe there's an afterlife. I think that when we die, that's the end of the story. And trying to live for an afterlife, I think, is a mistake. We really should live for the life that we have.
How do you handle the other? Let me point again, not towards issues of ethics or even issues of theodicy, but rather issues of origin. How do you handle the question of, in Heidegger's great formulation of this question, why is there anything rather than nothing?
Well, I don't have an answer for it. I'm not sure that anybody has an answer for it. My students at Chapel Hill are, you know, they tend to be from the South. They're from the Bible Belt. And sometimes they're amazed that I believe in evolution, and they can't believe that I think that we descended from earlier forms of primates. And I tell them that isn't the problem, that we descended from primates.
I tell them the Pope believes in evolution.
Yeah, right. No, I tell them that actually the problem is I think we descended from rocks. That's the problem. And they say, well, how do you explain that? I can't explain it. I'm not a scientist. I don't know. But that's what I think. I think we're here as a matter of pure chance. And we're lucky to be here, and we ought to take advantage of it.
And two things I want to put before you relevant to what you've just been saying. The first is in an email that I've just received within the last 5 minutes. In which the listener says the following to you. I fear you have misrepresented your favorite book in the Bible. You mentioned that in Ecclesiastes we are told to basically eat, drink, and be merry, as if there is no God. Yet Ecclesiastes ends in this way. Now, this is his quotation. You can tell me whether he's got it more or less accurately. But this is in quotes from Ecclesiastes, supposedly. The conclusion, when all has been heard, is fear God and keep his commandments, because this applies to every person. For God will bring every act to judgment, everything which is hidden, whether it is good or evil.
No, the writer is absolutely right. The book of Ecclesiastes does end that way. What's complicated is, and that I haven't been able to deal with here very much, is that scholars have long recognized that books of the Bible often have gone through numerous editions, and the book of Ecclesiastes is no exception. When somebody wanted to make Ecclesiastes sound more traditional in its piety, they redacted the book of Ecclesiastes by adding verses here and there, including the ending, so that the ending of Ecclesiastes is done by a pious redactor who is attempting to make it sound more in conformity with traditional piety found throughout other Israelite literature. So when I'm dealing with Ecclesiastes, I'm actually dealing with the earliest layer of the book, not with the later redactor.
Who laid down that earliest layer? He's commonly referred to as the preacher. Do you have any sense of who or what he might have been?
Well, he's claiming to be Solomon, of course. He claims to be the son of David who resides in Jerusalem, who's the richest man.
But we know it's not Solomon.
So it's not Solomon. And so scholars debate who it was. We actually don't have a name to attach to it, but it looks to me that probably it's somebody living about the 3rd century or so. So maybe 600 years after Solomon was living. And it's somebody...
That's 3rd century B.C.
B.C.E., yeah. Somebody who's been influenced by various kinds of philosophical thought that were floating around. A number of people have noted that, in fact, this book of Ecclesiastes sounds very similar to some strains of Epicurean thought, for example.
Uh-huh.
Epicureans were not hedonists. They didn't believe that you should have wild pleasure, but they did think that you should enjoy life, and you should have good family, and should have good friends, and should enjoy the simple pleasures of life, and that's, of course, what Ecclesiastes teaches.
I said I had two things I wanted to quote to you. The other is from an old friend of mine, who in fact was on this program just a few months ago, and will be on this program again the night after next, Martin Marty of the University of Chicago, who's a great historian of religion and is as well an ordained Lutheran pastor, as you know. And in just a little piece that he wrote in response to the book by Dawkins, who's one of the great pronouncing atheists these days, part of what you call the Holy Trinity? Or is it the other Holy Trinity?
The Holy Trinity of Atheists is Sam Harris and Christopher Hitchens and Dawkins, yes.
And leaves out Dennett, who's usually root for them.
Yes.
But commenting on Dawkins, here's what Martin says. His career and his book are devoted to opposing all religions and all manifestations of faith. He argues that humanity will truly be on the path to progress only after all traces of religion are expunged. And he calls on readers to join in the expunging. Actually, Freud did the same in his book 100 years earlier, The Future of an Illusion. But then, Martin Marty goes on to say the following. My vocation is to do my doubting within the context of faith. My theme, whether a Dawkins is on stage or not, is to note that around the world, faith communities, religion, and spiritual forces are growing in size and intensity. This is a phenomenon that has nothing to do with truth or falsehood, or with their goodness or evil. But the phenomenon does suggest that it is pointless to talk about and work on doing away with them. Energies are better spent observing the ways in which faith and faiths can heal, console, judge, offer interpretations of life, and build communities that work for the common good. What he's really saying there, and it's the first time I've heard him say this, is I've got my serious doubts, but that's not what's important. Religion is a great human reality. It serves very significant purposes to hold us together and make life bearable. And the best I can do and should do is to appreciate religion and in its diversity and try to track some of the changes through which it has gone, which is what he's done as an historian, to be sure. But this is an affirmation of faith because it's functional.
Right. So if there's a continuum between Dawkins and Martin Marty, I'm much closer to Martin Marty. I think that it's absurd to claim that religion is the source of all of our problems, and that the way these neo-atheists have claimed that religion is the problem. It's not really the problem. People have misused religion for bad ways, but they've misused all sorts of ideologies in bad ways.
But the great genocides have been done in the name of Marxism, more or less,
Well,
or in the name of Nazism.
Yeah, I mean, Nazism actually had a theological basis to it, but the Khmer Rouge did not have any theological basis to it, religious basis to
it. Nor did Stalin, nor did Mao Zedong.
That's right. And so when some people, like Sam Harris, says, well, they're really religions because they're of their ideology, but by that time he's robbed religion of any meaning. And I think the problem with people like Dawkins and Harris and some of these others is that they simply don't know very much about religion, and Martin Marty will not be accused of that.
But what message, then, do you want to convey, if any, to your readers and to your listeners this very night, many of whom are undoubtedly good believing Christians or good believing Jews?
I think that one of my goals is to get people to think about their faith. It's not to get them to change their faith. I don't try to convert people to agnosticism. I became an agnostic because I could no longer believe in a God who intervenes in this world, but other people do believe in a God who intervenes in this world. But if they think that, I want them to think about it and try and come to grips with how there can be so much pain and suffering in the world if their God is in control and if their God answers prayer. And it may be that they'll just say, well, it's all a mystery, or they'll come up with some other explanation. But it's more important for me that people think about what it is that they're standing for than that they simply stand on something that they were taught to believe when they were children.
Standing in opposition to that is something which many serious religionists have encountered and have written about at times. Namely, even if they're, you know, they're men of the cloth or women of the cloth, but they're suffering great pangs of doubt, they pray for an end to doubt, or they pray for a renewal of faith even in the face of doubt.
Right.
And I see that as a gift from God.
Right. I think doubt is a great thing.
What they're praying for is to end their intellectual to deactivate their intellectual excitements.
Yes, well, I think that that's a problem. I mean, whoever is a believer surely thinks that God gave them intelligence, and God-given intelligence ought to be used. It shouldn't be shunted. We shouldn't ignore the problems of the world or the problems that we have of faith. We ought to confront them head-on and go in the direction that we feel truth is leading us, even if it means being led away from the faith, as happened in my case.
It is time for me to invite telephone calls. We will be onto the phone shortly. We're pausing in just a minute or two, and a little bit more conversation, but then we'll get to the phone surely by 10 minutes after the hour or thereabouts. So the lines are now open. The number, as ever, is 591-7200. Any question you want to raise, any confession you want to make, any assertion you want to put forward, 591-7200, 312 is the area code if you're calling long distance. And if you're at a greater long distance and listening to us, particularly over the Internet, any place else in the world, and want to get into this conversation, the best way is via email. And the email address is extension720@tribune.com. Extension 720 as one word at Tribune, TRIBUNE.com, or 591-7200. We'll return directly after an update on the news from Jim Gutis. And directly back to Bart Ehrman and on to your calls right after the 10:15 break. And right now, all the calls, that is, all the phone lines, are taken, 591-7200. So you're not getting through if you're trying, but do persist and continue to try. Whenever we say goodnight to a prior caller, then, of course, a line is available. And as for email, that has infinite capacity. So if you want to email us, just do so to extension720@tribune.com. But a few things about the reaction to this book. All of your books have been quite popular. They've got a lot of attention. They're very readable. You do this very effectively. And in fact, you tell a great tale, whatever you're telling. And one can learn a great deal about the work of biblical scholars by your exposition of what has been discovered in the last few centuries, actually. What are you getting a different reaction to this book than you did to the others?
Yeah, I'd say actually that I am. I'm getting a lot more immediate reaction. The book just came out less than a week ago, and I've been getting hundreds of emails from people.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the constants I'm getting in these emails are people writing me to tell me what the solution is. So we have this biggest problem the human race has ever faced, and people in 12 lines or less can tell me what the answer is.
Well, is there some answer that most of them are settling upon? Which is the most commonly quoted?
Well, the one people have most often is the free will answer, that God has given us free will. Otherwise, we'd be like robots who are programmed to do what he wanted us to do. But since we have the free will to do what's good, we also have the free will to do what's evil. And that's how you can explain things like the Holocaust, because of people treating others in an evil way. And I certainly agree. That is a large part of why there's suffering in the world. But free will can't explain so many things. It can't explain a tsunami that kills 300,000 people or a mudslide in Colombia that kills 30,000 people in just a few minutes.
Can't explain the evil done by nature as distinguished from the evil done by man.
That's right. Yeah. And the other problem is that most of the people who believe in the free will answer tend to think that these tend to be Christians, so far as I can tell, and they think that when they die, they're going to go to heaven. And in heaven, there won't be any evil, but surely they believe there will be free will in heaven. So the existence of free will doesn't necessarily mean there has to be suffering. One could have created a world with free will without suffering, apparently, if their doctrine of heaven is correct.
A brief review in Time magazine runs through the basic content of your book, and then says, yes, but he just stays with the Bible. He should have gone on to the philosophers, because they really have addressed this problem in ways that speak more openly or more effectively to moderns. I think that's what he is implying rather than fully saying. What do the philosophers do with this?
Well, philosophers, you know, I actually did a lot of reading in the philosophy of theodicy for the book, and I actually found much of the philosophical discourse to be morally repugnant. Philosophers tend to deal with the question in the abstract and come up with very sophisticated answers to why there could be evil in the world if God is all-powerful and loving. But these answers, when you actually read the materials, seem to be so far removed from anything like real suffering that I find many of these responses somewhat repulsive. There's actually kind of an anti-theodicy movement among some philosophers who are also tired of this kind of discourse, and who argue that theodicy itself is an evil practice because it allows people to come up with solutions to suffering rather than engaging with suffering. That's an answer that I find a little bit more refreshing.
Don't explain suffering away. Rage against it.
Well, yeah. I mean, in my book, I end up by saying that I don't think that there is an answer. People probably on the lines now have an answer that they want to give me. I think that there's probably not an answer, but I think there is a response. And I think our response to suffering should be to try and alleviate it. We should do everything in our power to make the world a better place, not just for ourselves, although certainly that, but also for other people.
I tell you what. There are lots of people, indeed, who are clamoring to talk with you. Let's go to the phones right now rather than after the forthcoming commercials. 591-7200, and here is the first. Hello, you're on the air.
Yeah, I guess I didn't have the luxury of reading the book ahead of time, so I'm only getting a brief understanding of his arguments. But he uses certain success words when he talks about suffering altogether. I mean, without an absolute, how does one refer to suffering? You could always say, look at cancer from the cancer's point of view. I mean, it really just boils down, if you don't believe in an absolute being, then it's more of a materialist point of view where, and it may be glib, but what's wrong with 30,000 people dying in a tornado or in a hurricane or something like that? I mean, how can you have human life set up to be the standard for your arguments? I'm not saying that it has to, that there has to be a God or not, but I'm saying from your position, there doesn't seem to be a philosophical basis for it.
Yeah, thank you for the observation. It's a very interesting observation. My view is that the human is, in fact, the standard by which we gauge what's right and wrong and what's evil and what's good.
Man is the measure.
Man is the measure because, I mean, and I don't know why, but it's not that there's a philosophical argument for it. It's just that we seem to be this way. I don't know if we're hardwired this way, if there are psychological or physiological explanations for it, but when we see somebody suffering, we want to alleviate that suffering. It's just part of being human. And those who don't feel that way, I say, are not really being fully human. So
it's even part of being primate. You get the same in the higher apes,
yes,
surely.
That's right.
But that no more answers the question than just saying, because I said so.
Well, okay. But, I mean, unless you're willing to let people just starve to death, then I don't see what the objection is.
Right. But it's not up to me. What I'm talking about, what you're saying, your argument is that it's because I said so. That's not what I'm saying. I don't think people should starve to death. But the whole basis for your book, it sounds like, is that we should do good because you say so, because man should just do good. I mean, it sounds very circular to me.
Okay. Well, my book is actually about how the different authors of the Bible deal with the problem, and much less about my own views about it. But my own views happen to be that human beings should live life for the as fully as they can and should help others do the same.
Why? You know, one might paraphrase. I'm sorry, I cut that fellow off as he wants to go on, but we're about to pause. My apologies to him. But I somehow think of Sophie Tucker's great line. I've been rich and I've been poor, and believe me, honey, rich is better. You can adapt that. I've been good and I've been bad, and believe me, good is better.
Yes, that's certainly my point of view.
And with that, we'll pause and take some good messages and then return to Bart Ehrman and to your calls and emails to him, 591-7200 for email, rather for phone calls, and extension 720 at tribune.com for email. Directly back after this. And my guest, to reintroduce him once again, is Bart Ehrman, a much-published and very interesting author, who is, in real life, chairman of the Department of Religious Studies at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and his newest book is titled God's Problem, How the Bible Fails to Answer Our Most Important Question, Why We Suffer. And that book has been much commended by reviewers and by other readers who are quoted on the back page of the book. 591-7200 is our number, and you are the next caller. Good evening.
Good evening. excuse me. I tend to agree with your guest, and my question to him is how much of his thinking has been informed by Dostoevsky and his idea of children suffering and that of Voltaire and the earthquake of Lisbon in the 18th century. I'll hang up and take my answer.
No, stay with us, sir. It's better that way.
Yeah, so you've picked two of my favorite authors when it comes to suffering. Voltaire, when I was in college, maybe even started me on this quest of trying to figure out why they're suffering with Candide, which I just thought was a wonderful reaction to Leibniz's view that this world is the best of all possible worlds. Dostoevsky has been a very serious influence on me, and in fact, I deal with Dostoevsky in my book, in my final chapter. In The Brothers Karamazov, the one chapter people seem to know about is the Grand Inquisitor. But two chapters before the Grand Inquisitor, there's a couple of chapters in which the two brothers, Alyosha and Ivan, are having a discussion precisely about suffering. It's this passage that you're referring to, in which little children suffer such horrible things, and Ivan, the skeptic, doesn't think that there can be any justification for it. And in fact, he says that if at the end of time God explains himself and shows why it was all necessary, he's not going to believe it even then. This is why the chapter is called Rebellion, because he's in a state of rebellion. I'm not sure I actually agree with that myself. I think that if, in fact, an almighty divine being explained everything to me so it absolutely made sense, I'd probably fall down on my knees in front of him, but not Ivan. And it's a very powerful chapter that I recommend highly, because it takes this problem of suffering so very seriously.
Sir, well, thank you for the call.
Thank you very much.
And you would agree with Candide at the end, where he says, "Il ne faut que cultiver notre jardin." It is necessary. One need only cultivate one's own garden.
Yes, cultivate one's own garden. That's that is my my philosophy as well. I think we can't solve these problems intellectually, but we can live life. So we should.
At least in the present, the pleasant precincts of Chapel Hill.
Yes, yes, indeed.
Back to the phones, 591-7200, the number, and here is the next caller. Good evening.
Yes, hello, Milt. Your guest had mentioned that he had a born-again experience earlier in his life. I would like to know, how does he look upon or explain that experience now?
Yes, an interesting question.
Yeah, thank you. It is a good question. I was 16 years old, and looking back on it, I think it's a little bit, I look on it as a little bit strange now, because I was actually a very active church person at the time. I was in the Episcopal Church, and I confessed my sins every week. I believed in Christ and prayed to God, but I had a born-again experience, because I had been convinced by somebody that my religion wasn't sufficient. I needed to ask Jesus into my heart, and then I would have eternal life, but that as a good Episcopalian, I didn't yet have eternal life. I look back on it as, I guess, more in psychological terms, that I was in need of something at the time, and that this provided me with some kinds of assurance about the meaning of life and my place in the universe, and that it provided me with the kind of certitude that those sorts of experiences often provide. When you look around the country today, you find that it is largely very conservative churches that bring in members today more than mainline churches, in part because they provide certain answers. And the certitude that was provided by that experience for me, I think, was very seductive. And it's what led me then to commit myself so strongly to my evangelical faith.
So you feel that it was kind of a self, like, you were doing it to yourself, like a psychological kind of explanation rather than a real, you know, manifestation of God, something really otherworldly happening?
That's right. I no longer believe in God. I'm an agnostic, so I don't think God was intervening on my behalf at that time. I think that everybody who has a genuine religious experience like this is having some kind of psychological experience that seems very real, of course, but I don't believe that there's some kind of exterior divine being who is reaching down and touching people.
Okay, thank you.
Uh-huh. You know, I didn't press on as I should have. Let me do it just right now with regard to the matter that I raised by reading that little quotation from Martin Marty. You don't believe in God, you say. Of course, you're an agnostic, which is not an assertion that there is no God. It's an assertion that you don't know a cognitive route to produce a final answer to the question.
Well, that's right. I don't agree with the atheists who a lot of atheists try to get me to admit that I'm an atheist. And I mean, I don't believe in the Christian God anymore. That's true. I don't believe that the God who answers prayer and intervenes in our world exists. But is there some superior force in the universe that's beyond what I can imagine? I don't know. And either does Dawkins, by the way. He doesn't know either.
But so, I want to come then to this simple question. Would it be a better or a worse world, a more trustworthy one or a more chaotic one, if everyone believed, or rather did not believe, as you do not believe, i.e., if religion, organized religion, communal religion, disappeared?
I don't think it's easy to answer the question. I think that I think there's a lot of harm that is done in the name of religion, and there's a lot of good that's done in the name of religion. And I think the reason there's both harm and good is because it's people doing it. And if there wasn't religion, there'd still be a lot of harm done, and there'd still be a lot of good done.
I'm probably agnostic as you are, though very fascinated by things religious and by religious history and so on. But as a sociologue of some sort, trained in social psychology and reading as I have in my time, rather widely in social history, my sense is that you don't maintain the complex human systems, complex social systems, without some shared central set of values, which are also symbolized and which have associated rituals which bind people together, i.e., that's what religion does for us.
Well, that's right. I think the real problem is for people like me who leave the their religion is what they put in its place, because it provides so many things, including just personal contact and fellowship and social outlets and opportunities for doing good.
Yeah, well, you reveal in the book that your wife remains religious and she drags you to church some of the time.
Rarely, yes, but she is. She's a committed Anglican. Yes.
Yeah. Probably she doesn't drag you. Probably you're glad to go there all the same.
Well, I go because occasionally I'll go because she really wants me to go. And she's an intellectual. She's a scholar herself. And for her, the kinds of problems I wrestle with, she doesn't wrestle with. She's convinced that, in fact, I'm still a fundamentalist. The way my mind works.
Let me give you another question that comes to us by way of email. Very simple and very basic. What is your perception and belief relating to the New Testament's Jesus?
I think that Jesus is best understood as a first century apocalyptic prophet who anticipated that the end of the world was going to come within his own generation, that God would soon intervene and overthrow the forces of evil and bring in a good kingdom on earth, and that his disciples would be alive to see it happen. So actually, the first time you and I talked, Milt, was about my book, Jesus, Apocalyptic Prophet of the New Millennium, where I, in a book-length study, I tried to show that that's probably who the historical Jesus was.
Does historical Jesus research now basically converge on that interpretation?
The majority of scholars in Germany and America since the time of Albert Schweitzer have held this point of view and continue to hold this point of view, even though there's a very large minority of scholars, a vocal minority, the Jesus Seminar, as it's called, that takes a different point of view. But I think the majority of scholars continue to hold this idea.
What view do the Jesus Seminar people take?
They think that Jesus was not an apocalypticist, that he was a speaker of great wisdom.
Just a wisdom teacher. A
Jewish holy man. Yeah. Some of them think that he was more like a cynic philosopher, but that he wasn't somebody who anticipated an imminent act of God that would destroy the forces of evil.
But did not represent himself as the Son of God.
I think probably... some people think he did represent himself as the Son of God, but that doesn't mean that he represented himself as divine. It would have some other connotation in the first century Palestine.
This is impossible to put to you as a simple question, particularly as we have to go in just a moment to another round of the newscast. But what then accounts for the persistence of Christianity beyond the death of Jesus? What accounts for Pauline doctrine, or was Paul also apocalyptic, expecting the end of things?
Yes, Paul definitely was apocalyptic, expecting the end of things. And the difference from Jesus is that Jesus thought that someone that he called the Son of Man was going to come in judgment on the earth, and Paul thought that Jesus was going to come on judgment on the earth. He was an apocalypticist living after what he interpreted to be the resurrection of Jesus, and that's the difference between Paul and Jesus.
How then does it take off, and why does it flourish 2,000 years later?
Yes. Well, I teach a semester-long PhD seminar on this question, and it takes about 4 months to get to the bottom of it. So I'm afraid in 20 seconds, I just can't.
You can't give me a quoted answer.
I can give you a 20-second version.
Go ahead.
Christians maintained that their religion was right and all other religions were wrong, and that was unique in the Roman Empire. So that when they converted people to Christianity, they took people away from the pagan religions. Whereas in paganism, if you converted somebody to paganism, they remained pagan. So Christianity destroyed other religions in its wake as it grew. It grew at a rate of about 40% every decade for several centuries, and then the Emperor Constantine converted, and that changed everything.
That way of looking at the history of Christianity, in fact, parallels what you get in the rise and the decline and fall of the Roman Empire, Edwin Gibbon's book.
Of course, his view of this was very influential. I think today, though, what people think is not that Christianity filled some kind of void that was there as religion grew weaker in the empire, the way Gibbon thought, but that, in fact, religion was very strong, and it was the strength of other religions that allowed Christianity to succeed because people were basically religious and were very interested in new religious movements.
Fascinating stuff, of course. And we pause for an update on the news for that to the newsroom and Paula Cooper. And as we return to Bart Ehrmond and to discourse around his new book, God's Problem, How the Bible Fails to Answer Our Most Important Question, Why We Suffer. As we return to that conversation, we now have got at last have a few lines available. If you've been trying to reach us, make another quick try. Somebody will get through on 591-7200. But let me read you a simple email that I've got in front of me. Your attitude about eliminating suffering could go so far as to justify murder. That is, if we should alleviate suffering at all costs, it justifies euthanasia.
I think that people have to make decisions about what is ethical and what isn't ethical. I don't think that's limited to somebody who believes we should eliminate suffering. I mean, I think everybody thinks we should eliminate suffering. The question is, under what conditions is it appropriate to behave in certain ways? So I don't really take a stand on euthanasia one way or the other.
A quotation that's always stuck in my mind, something I encountered when I was a graduate student in psychology. A leading psychologist of that period, rather a long time ago, was Edwin Garrigues Boring of Harvard, who, in his book on sensation, gets off this wonderful line, pain. This is the opening of his chapter on pain. Pain is notoriously unpleasant. That's the first sentence
yes,
of that
indeed.
Chapter. And it takes a visit to the dentist or yet other things to verify that very simple observation. Yet, there are those who find redemption in pain. The role of pain in religious life is of great interest, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And I actually deal with this a bit in the book, because there are views that, that suffering itself and pain, it can be redemptive. But, you know, the...
Even the induction of pain as a religious practice.
Yes, well, absolutely. There are certainly religions that, that practice this. But, you know, in response to what this person is saying, I mean, the alternative, of course, is to prolong life at all costs, and that also is dubious ethically. I remember when my own dad was dying of cancer, and his pain was so great he couldn't bear it, but the doctor didn't want to increase his dosage of morphine because he was afraid that he'd get addicted. I said, this man's dying. Why? But you know, the idea of prolonging life at any cost, itself ethically dubious, I think.
We go back to the phones, 591-7200. Good evening.
Thanks for a great discussion.
Thank you, sir.
I'd like to say that I think that you're probably discovering more and more Christians are sharing your viewpoint. Some of us still stay in belief of God, and you have moved on. I mean, my life parallels yours religiously, but I don't believe that I was in depth in the earthly church as much as you were. I believe that I came from a supreme being. I believe I'll return back to the supreme being, and that there is that constant imprinting within. But the point that I would like to make is you referred to the loving God. My background in religious studies showed a vengeful God until Christ, and then a loving God that came after his teachings. And I'd like to hear more about your opinion of that. And then there's one other correlation I'd like to make. The American Indian and how they refer to suffering. If you truly study what they believed, they did not blame the Caucasian or blame the white man for what happened to them. They blamed themselves as a culture. They did something to offend the Great Spirit, and therefore the suffering came upon them. Thanks.
Yeah. Let me respond especially to your first comment, because it's very common to think that the God of the Old Testament is wrathful and vengeful, and then the God of Jesus came along and that he was loving and kind and forgiving. And I think, in fact, that probably it's not quite that simple, because, when Jesus himself was asked to summarize his teaching and the teaching of the law, he said that the whole law can be summarized in the commandments to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and strength, and to love your neighbor as yourself. In other words, love is the center of the Jewish law. And God in the Hebrew Bible is portrayed as a loving, as a bridegroom, and as a loving parent. So I don't think it's fair to say that the Old Testament God is simply a God of wrath. And it's also not fair to say that the God of the New Testament is only a God of love and has no wrath. Anyone can read the book of Revelation and see that, in fact, the New Testament God himself is full of wrath. He's going to destroy this world in very ugly ways, according to the book of Revelation. So I don't think that there's a simple correlation between wrath and the Old Testament God and love and the New Testament God.
Okay. And I do think in the future, as you deal more with people that have suffered and lived through the suffering, I think in some way you will find a return to your spiritual being. And just a prediction. I think you will find something before the end of your life. I think you'll find a peace with that. But just because of you're going to find other people that have suffered, and you're going to know more about them.
Well, anything
and
is possible.
And I wish you well. I wish you well on that, because I
think
you will.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, sir, for the call. And we wish you well as well. And to another caller on 591-7200. Good evening.
Yes, good evening. Well, just to follow up a bit on the last caller, I think that doubt is part of the human condition, and it can be the beginning of wisdom. I come from a Catholic tradition, and even though I learned many of my beliefs as a child, I came to realize the fullness of them as I moved into adulthood, and now very deeply into adulthood over many years. So I do believe that God is just, and he is merciful. He's all-knowing. He's infinite, and he's all-loving and merciful. I come also from many years in the medical field, so I've seen a great deal of human suffering at various levels throughout my life. But one of the best, even though I'm a cradle Catholic, one of the best explanations I have heard for human suffering, I heard from a wonderful man of the Jewish faith, a somewhat noted scholar, author, lecturer, and his statement was that generally God does not intervene with nature. And this relates to my long-held belief concerning the reality of evil and where it came from and what the results were. And I think that as this relates to doubts that people have, somewhat I was getting the impression listening this evening, Dr. Rosenberg, that I was hearing the comments from the God is Dead movement of the 60s, 70s that was somewhat prevalent at that time. But I realize your guest does not admit to being an atheist. But as far as this relates to the condition of human suffering and why God allows it, again, because of human beings haven't been given, I believe, by God, haven't been given free will, and the test that was given to Adam in order to exercise that will, the actual reality of not bringing that will into harmony with God's will did produce disastrous results. I mean, all of I believe that Garden of Eden, whether it's considered figuratively mm-hmm. or literally, was a place of absolute harmony.
So in,
in
Adam's fall, we sin it all.
Yes.
Let's get some response on that.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I obviously agree with you that God doesn't intervene in nature. I think my point is that that's not the traditional Judeo-Christian view, because the whole point of both, I mean, the theology of the ancient Israelites was rooted in the belief that God had intervened in nature, that he had saved his people from their slavery in Egypt at the Red Sea.
Yes, I believe that.
Oh,
believe
well, but that is.
They can do that, and I have seen that in my own lifetime. In my religion, we would call that a miracle.
We're getting rather short on time. Let's get a full explication.
Yeah, well,
I mean,
either God does intervene or he doesn't. I mean, I think if you say that he doesn't intervene in nature, my point is that that's not the traditional Christian or Jewish view, which is fine, because I think that in fact it's hard to believe that God does intervene because of all the massive suffering that we see around us.
Our thanks to that caller, and right on the button we go to the studio for to the control room for a last round of commercials, and then right back to your calls. I see now one or two lines available again. 591-7200 the number, and for email extension 720 at tribune.com. And we return directly to your calls for Bart Ehrman. 591-7200 is the number. You are on the air. Good evening.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call.
Our pleasure, sir.
My experience more or less parallels Dr. Ehrman's. I have a quick question. I've continued my search. Maybe I'm still in the grieving stage or whatever. But I recently read a book by two Quaker pastors named Gully and Mulholland called If Grace is True, Why God Will Save Every Person. It argues for what's known as Christian Universalism, that eventually everybody will be saved. And I guess I have two questions. I'm a little embarrassed to be advocating an answer, but is Christian Universalism a possible, I don't know, explanation or argument against theodicy? And secondly, as a biblical scholar, is there an argument for it in studying the Bible? Are there enough verses for it? To ask Dr. Ehrman's theological expertise there, or scholarly expertise?
For universalism, yeah. Well, theologians over the years have embraced some form of universalism, and they've pointed to verses, for example, in the book of Romans, where it says that just as in Adam all died, in Christ all will be made alive. And that verse only makes sense in one interpretation if, in fact, everybody has salvation in Christ, because everybody was affected by Adam. And so there is theological basis for it. Does that deal with the problem of theodicy? I think the problem is still, it may be that in the afterlife all things are made right that have here been made wrong. My view is that the view of the Christian doctrine of the afterlife itself was created as a theodicy, that the earliest Christians didn't believe that you died and went to heaven. They believed that this world was going to be transformed and our bodies with it, but that when that never happened, Christians started thinking that, in fact, what was going to take place was something glorious at death. You know, it may be that, I mean, some people find comfort in that, that that even those who suffer here will have a glorious eternity. And, I don't believe that myself, because I don't believe in a divine being who's overseeing this world, but I can see how it would provide comfort for people.
Thanks for taking my call, Doctor.
Well, we thank you, sir, for the call. And let me read you an email of considerable interest. I am a big fan of Dr. Ehrman and have purchased 4 of his courses from the teaching company, all of which I greatly enjoyed. Many years ago, I read the multi-volume Story of Civilization by Will Durant. One of the recurring themes of the book seemed to be that the cultural and intellectual elites of all societies, from ancient Greece to the Enlightenment, have come to a more or less agnostic explanation of reality. However, since these elites felt that religion provided a strong social bond that kept the, quote, lower classes in line, they perpetuated the religious norms of the time. I would appreciate Dr. Ehrman's thoughts on this point.
Yes, well, it's an interesting point, isn't it? And I often get asked this very question, as somebody who himself is not religious now, do I think that religion is used by the powerful in order to keep the powerless in line? I think sometimes it certainly happens that way, but I think it's difficult to think that all religion is of that sort, because so much religion is from the grassroots up. Many times it's not simply an overlord telling people what to believe. I mean, many religious movements in my part of the country, for example, in the South, there's no hierarchy with the upper class elites dictating what lower class people think. These are lower class movements. And so I think there is some of that, but I think that Durant went way too far in saying that is sort of how religion generally works in society.
I mentioned Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire earlier. I just searched out one of my favorite quotations from it, which bears upon these matters. And he says in the very first book, various modes of worship in the Roman Empire, of course, various modes of worship were all considered by the people as equally true, by the philosophers as equally false, and by the magistrates as equally useful.
Yes, indeed. There is some truth in that. We do know that the elites in the Roman Empire often were far more skeptical, and the more highly educated people, of course, were more highly skeptical, and there weren't that many highly educated people. They tended to be the elites. Philosophers tended to doubt a lot of things. That was what they were in the business of doing.
Yet you well know that in your world, I mean the world of the academy, of the universities, the intellectual world, there are many who have the position you hold, but surely you've encountered lots of others, even in the hard sciences, who indeed are devout in their own way and are devout in terms of some particular tradition. I've got good friends who are famous, world-famous lawyers who are Orthodox Jews and quite serious and committed Catholics, and so on.
Yes, I tell people that the kind of agnosticism that I embrace is not a matter of smarts. It's not that some of us are smarter than others, and therefore we know that religion, in fact, is not true. One of the things in universities is that departments of religious studies tend to be somewhat notorious because they tend to be populated by people who are agnostics and atheists. Not everybody, but I venture to say there are probably far more believing Christians and faithful Jews in the natural sciences than there are in religious studies departments, as it turns out.
Religious studies departments very often take their graduate students and disabuse them, whether intentionally or not,
yes,
of their own religious faith.
Yes,
that's just what happened to you.
Yes, it does happen.
How about this one? Another email. Do you think the writings of Paul Tillich of the University of Chicago still hold up today? I'm taking my first philosophy class, and my instructor insists that Tillich is the end-all and be-all of religion.
Oh, well, that's interesting. I think Paul Tillich has not read nearly as much as he was when I was in graduate school 25 years ago. And it's true for a lot of the great giants of various strands of, well, I mean, if you define neo-orthodoxy very, very broadly. When I was a graduate student, the New Testament scholar that everybody read was Rudolf Bultmann. And today hardly anybody reads Rudolf Bultmann. And I think times have simply moved on.
How would you summarize, if you could, what Tillich's theology really asserted?
Well, you know, Tillich is an interesting case in point, precisely for these neo-atheists that we've been talking about who attack religion as being so foolish and senseless, because Tillich, in fact, was quite brilliant and didn't hold to the idea of a personal divine being who intervened in history the way traditional Christianity did. For him, God is the ground of our being, that it's hard to put it in other language, but it's almost as if it's the life force that provides us with our existence, so that it isn't a personal grandfather up in the sky who occasionally intervenes in life.
Back to the phones now, 591-7200, as we go quickly to another. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello, Milt.
Yes,
Dr. Ehrman. I'm in awe. I believe both of you are intellects. I guess I'm in awe of your intellect. And then I also remember the verse in the Bible that says, man's wisdom is foolishness to God, which in my life I began an atheist, or at least an agnostic, and probably by trying to prove how foolish the Bible was, I came back to God, and not being brainwashed by any church or any organization, totally reading the Word of God and disbelieving everything in it, but yet kind of a yin yang thing, as this conversation is tonight, that is just at the right exact time for me, and listening. It's a beautiful conversation.
Well, I'm glad we've been of service, sir. I fear that we're almost out of time, but I do thank you for that call. And we will be closing down in just a moment. Let's make very clear that the title of Bart Ehrman's new book, and by the way, if you don't know Bart Ehrman's work yet, you should get clear on the spelling. It's Ehrman. And the title of the new book is God's Problem, How the Bible Fails to Answer Our Most Important Question, Why We Suffer. And that's just published by
Harper One.
And with that, we're going to wind down in just a moment.